This is a production of Cornell University.
Good evening, and thanks so much for joining us. I'm Alice Fulton, and as most of you know, I'm a member of the English department and the creative writing program here. Before I introduce tonight's readers, I just want to thank those who made this evening possible. We're all hugely grateful to the anonymous donors who provide funding for events in the creative writing program. Everything we do begins with them. And I also want to thank very much Elena Viramontes, who was director of creative writing when we started planning this evening. And she had great faith in this project and gave it her full support and was indispensable to its realization. I want to single out Karen Cujay for special thanks. Yay! Now, we all know without Karen, I mean, we wouldn't have any of the comforts that we now enjoy, including a room to stand in tonight, or a tablecloth for the table. Over the past few weeks, she's come up with creative solutions to so many weird problems, and she's done it with grace, patience, and fortitude, as well as imagination. And Monica Burke, who I've just met this week, donated her time, energy, to light this room, and without her creative solutions, we'd all be in the dark up here. Yay, Monica. Yeah. And we're thankful to Molly Kirker for her help with the programs. And J. Robert Lennon helped the MFA poets record their work and send it to Joe Klein as part of the collaboration. That was the first step. You'll hear more about that from Joe, that process. But John interviews all of the writing program's visitors for the Writers at Cornell blog. And he somehow manages to come up with great questions and get these interviews posted every time. He gets them posted right away. And I've already heard John's really interesting interview with Joseph Klein. It's online at the Writers at Cornell blogspot.com. So thank you, John, for all of the work that you do. Really appreciate it. Yeah, John. The Greek poet Kavafi wrote, "As you set out for Ithaca, hope the journey is a long one." And Joseph Klein's journey here amply fulfilled that wish. Late Wednesday night, his flight was canceled. He was stranded in the Newark airport, and all the hotels were booked, and he had nowhere to stay. And I want to thank my husband, Hank DeLeo, for his generous late-night help with that emergency and with so many other details of this performance. And finally, we're all so grateful for the amazing expertise of Barney Cole and Ted Hutchinson, sound engineers extraordinaire, who overcame the challenges of this space with such goodwill. Their experience and skill, in conjunction with Joe Klein's, is the foundation of what we're going to hear tonight. So let's give them a hand. What can I say about our four extraordinary student poets whose poems comprise Klein's Cornell set? I'm just so happy to be reading with them. It's so much fun, and they're so wonderful in class, they're great company, and I'm a big fan of their work, the biggest fan probably at the moment, but that will change. The program contains their bio notes, and I don't want to reiterate, so I thought I'd just mention some of their less academic accomplishments. Writers, of course, traditionally pay their dues with a string of interesting day jobs. Tacy from Cove, Arizona, is a Navajo of the Sheeprock people and the Tangle people. I meant to sort of verify that with Tacy, but I'm improvising, so. Okay. She's a recipient of the Truman Capote Creative Writing Fellowship, the Corson Browning Poetry Prize, and Morningstar Creative Writing Award. Tacy has been a semi-professional pineapple cutter, a sheep intestine cleaner, an Indian princess, that's a good gig, and a flamingo in her second grade play. Clayton Pittock came to us from Pittsburgh, PA, where he worked as a caddy at a famous golf course and as a substitute high school elementary school teacher, and that is a hard gig, actually. He has spent 3 summers at the New York State Summer Writers Institute in Saratoga, New York. Benjamin Garcia originally is from Albuquerque, New Mexico. He worked at a Mexican rodeo for a long time from a very young age. That explains a lot, actually. He later worked at a hospital as a Spanish translator and as an HIV prevention educator. He has received fellowships from the Breadloaf Writers Conference and the Taos Summer Writers Conference. Before coming to Cornell, Beth Rogers spent 2 years teaching in rural China. She lived in an old house whose roof was painted in evil eyes. She also lived in Indonesia, where she regularly experienced earthquakes. In addition to being a poet, Beth is a dancer and a musician. Although she's only 5'1", she has a gift for leaping and jumping high. People sometimes ask how I met Joseph Klein, and I had to ask him, actually, to answer this. I knew I met him at University of Michigan, but he has a really good memory, and he said it must have been sometime in 1998 that he contacted me after reading my poems and said he was looking for a title to a movement of his piece, Occam's Razor, and he asked me to suggest lines from my work that he might use. In an early email, Joe mentioned that he was currently working on pieces influenced by the writings of Darcy Wentworth Thompson and Elias Canetti, and I said those two figures had inspired some of my work as well. So immediately we were just hitting it off, and we felt we had something in common. And about a year later, in 1999, I was able to invite Joe to University of Michigan, and he visited my graduate seminar on fractal poetics. And the title of my long poem about music for bone and membrane instrument is taken from the program notes for Joe's piece, The Road in Its Unfoldings, a title he found in my work. So it's kind of this feedback loop that we have going here. Joe Klein is such a distinguished composer and such a nice guy. I don't know how to do justice to both of those things, but he holds a Doctor of Music degree in composition from Indiana University. He's currently Distinguished Professor at the University of North Texas College of Music, where he has served as Chair of Composition Studies since 1999. His catalog ranges from solo pieces to works for large ensemble, including instrumental, vocal, and electroacoustic music, often incorporating intermedia, such as tonight, or theatrical elements. His compositional work reflects on his ongoing interest in musical processes drawn from such sources as fractal geometry and chaos theory, often inspired by natural phenomena. Joe has worked with writing by Kafka, John Ashbery, and W.S. Merwin. His compositions have been performed and broadcast throughout the Americas, Europe, and Asia, and have been featured at international music venues in Amsterdam, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Taiwan, and North Korea. Cornell Set, the work that's premiering here tonight, goes by very quickly, I think, but it will have a life beyond tonight's performance, as all of Joe's pieces do. The really fun thing about having your poetry set by Joe is that the poems will be read by different readers all over the world. Different performers in years to come will be reading these poems with Joe's music, and in fact, a performance is already planned at University of North Texas. Joe has been a featured guest composer at so many universities, I won't even list them all, Northwestern and University of Michigan, SUNY Buffalo, on and on. His research and teaching interests include postmodern aesthetics, intermediate composition, the social and cultural context of contemporary music, the role of the composer today, contemporary musical notation, and the work of Frank Zappa. And I believe Joe teaches a course in Frank Zappa, which must be really fun. And I quote from Frank in one of my poems, too, actually. One of my poems. I love The Mothers of Invention. Joe has received awards and honors from the National Endowment for the Arts, the American Composers Forum, Jerome Foundation, the American Music Center, the Gaudeamus Foundation of Amsterdam, and ASCAP. His works are recorded on the Innova, Centaur, Crystal, and Mark labels. And that's just to give you an idea of what a great presence he is, but you'll see that for yourself. It's such an honor and a true delight to have Joseph Klein here tonight, so let's welcome him.
Well, I'm humbled by Alice's introduction, and I really appreciate not only the invitation to come here, your friendship as well, and your artistry, which has been very inspiring to me. And I also want to thank Cornell University for the commission for this work and for the opportunity to come here and do the premiere performance and to work with these fine MFA poetry students. I'd like to start at the beginning of this by just saying a little bit about this project. The second part of the program will be a performance of the work of Alice's that I set, the three poems from Felt, and I'll say a few words about that before we do that performance. I'd like to say a few words about this project. Alice contacted me, I think it was last spring or something like that, about this opportunity, and I'd been thinking about another work like this. I enjoyed so much working with her poems and setting them to computer music that I'd been thinking I'd like to do that again. So when the opportunity came up, I really jumped on it, and particularly when I knew it would be the poetry students here at Cornell, which has such a great reputation. So we kind of worked out the details of how this would work, and the four second-year MFA students were then contacted and I guess asked to provide some poems. We had to set the parameters of what length the poem should be. I basically figured they should probably be single-page poems so that would give a little bit more space to the music, and I wouldn't have discrepancies between one poem that's very long and one poem that's very short. When we first came up with the idea, or she presented the idea, we went back and forth a little bit, and we determined that what we would do is she would select three poems of each of the students or ask them to provide three of these poems. And then they would be sent to me, and then I would go through and select one of each of theirs to include in this set. And in addition to the kind of parameter of having one-page poems, I also requested that the poets read their poems and record the poems so I could have those. And that was for two reasons, one of which is I really wanted to get the sense of the personality of each of the poets and the way that they read, and I could really get a sense of just their own voices, not only their voice as a poet, but their literal voices. But also, the works that I do with computer music tend to use a lot of text-based sound files, audio sources. So the materials that I wanted to use in these poems, I knew would be based in text, that a lot of the source material would be text-based. And let me say a few words about the process itself. These works, the computer music part, is all based on acoustic sounds, either the spoken text that were provided by the poets or by nature sounds or various other kinds of sounds. They weren't synthesized at all, like with MIDI or any kind of synthesis program. They were really taken from source material in nature and then processed in multiple ways, so that sometimes the resulting sound is far removed from the original source. And we talked about this a little bit today, and I played a few examples where you really have to listen to hear the original source material in the resulting sound material. And I think as a composer, I really like that idea of taking something and transforming it in a way that it becomes something else. And there were a few cases where some material started out, for example, in Beth's piece, there was a reference to crickets, which is also a reference in Alice's piece, and I actually used literal crickets as the source material in there, and I wanted to do something a little bit different, and I was messing around processing some of the gong sounds, and by stretching them out and transposing them and doing different manipulations with them, created a sound that was very insect-like out of the gong, and in fact, the gongs are part of the background in Beth's poetry setting of that poem. So it was a kind of process where I knew the resulting sound I wanted, and starting with the source material, and then figuring out a way to get it to that point. And that's part of the fun of composing, is trying to manipulate these materials in this way. So when I was provided with not only the poems, but these recordings, part of my decision was based on the sounds of the poets reading these works. And there were some other things that I took into consideration. And maybe I'd like to say a few words. You've got the poems right there, so maybe I'll refer to some of them individually and tell you what I was thinking when I looked at them. The first one that's on the set tonight is Tacey Atsidy's Gorge Dweller, Even Song 1. And what I was attracted to about that poem is a few things. There were a lot of really interesting imagery in there. It wasn't a narrative poem. I liked the kind of play of the words in each of the lines, and also the structure of the poem where the lines keep recurring at different points. And there's this really great nested structure where a line will keep coming back. Well, it only comes back one time each, but you get this kind of recursive quality going on. I started working on Clayton Pittock's piece, and was using his poem and his reading of his poem and transforming the sound to come up with the computer music. And I realized that the sounds I was coming up with were actually more interesting for Tacey's piece. So I put Clayton's piece aside and I went to Tacey's and started to manipulate all of the lines of text that she was reading in the recording I had. And as it turns out, when you listen to the poem tonight, just to be aware of the fact that every single sound of the computer music in that setting of Gorge Dweller is from Tacey's reading of the poem. So all of it is from vocal sounds, from the text that's in there. And in fact, each line of text is what generates the music for that's accompanying each line. So a lot of it, you'll never have any idea that it comes from the human voice. It'll sound like rocks or like leaves or like water or raindrops, different kinds of sounds, but not from the source material. In Clayton's piece, LG for a Car, actually that one and Ben's piece, What is Broken, or more narrative work, so I was thinking in terms of kind of linear setting of those things. And in both pieces, I was thinking, I kind of broke them into sections. We kind of talked about this today. Poets have a kind of way of thinking about form, and of course when somebody else approaches the poem, they think about it differently. It may not be what the poet thought. It may not necessarily be wrong, even if it's different from the poet's vision. But once you put your work out there, whether you're a poet or a visual artist or a musician, it's up to the audience, to the reader, to the listener, to interpret that work. And I don't think there really are bad interpretations. Some of them are better than others, but I think that any interpretation, it can be valid. So one of the things I did was break these poems apart, both Ben's and Clayton's, and look for places where the poem could break for places for the music to come through. And so I looked at that in a kind of structural way like that. But what I liked about both of them, in the case of Clayton's piece, there's imagery of a car, vultures are used metaphorically, there's dog references, and so certain images were very strong and had very, very clear sonic associations. And so immediately I started making a kind of catalog of what sounds I wanted to use, dog sounds, car sounds, and of course there's so many sounds associated with cars, I kind of ended up limiting them to basically an ignition sound and then a rumbling engine sound. And those became the source material for most of the music that is in there. There are a couple places in there where actually Clayton's voice in his reading of the poem was transformed to create some of the sound. And then there's dog howling, whining, growling sounds that are transformed as well. And I think in that poem, when you listen to it, you'll be able to hear a little bit more clearly the references to the sound material, the source material, way more so than in Tacey's poem setting, because I think you really, it'd be hard to really figure where some of those sounds came from. But I told you they came from her speaking, so you already know that. In Benjamin's piece, which also had a narrative kind of structure, there are certain references to rain and chain link fence and birds. These are things, again, which could be pretty easily represented sonically. So in fact, that the background of his entire poem is this rain sound, which essentially transforms to a fairly straightforward kind of presentation of rain and thunderstorm. And then as the poem progresses, that rain transforms and it's processed in a way so by the end of it, it has a kind of pitched material sound to it. It sounds very artificial, but it's a very gradual transformation. It might be kind of hard to hear. At the same time, there are also these other sounds that are coming out that are based on transformation of bird sounds. There's another sound, that the idea of being something being broken in the piece. I used a breaking glass to create sound that was highly transformed. You'll never know it's a glass breaking sound because of the transformation. It creates these kind of high-pitched, almost like crackling sounds that happen at the top, but not glass-like. And it has a kind of reference to the birds that are referred to in there. Or the bird, I guess, single. I want to make sure I get everything on there. Oh, I already said that. Okay, so those two poems have tracks that are actually the Pittock and the Garcia poems. The tracks are overlapped in ways. Well, in the case of Benjamin's piece, there's one single track and then other tracks that are overlapped. And then in the case of Tacey's poem, they were all triggered by each line. I'll talk a little bit more about that. So there's a lot of layering going on with the sounds. In the case of Elizabeth's piece, In Mid-Autumn, I really like that piece, and the poem, it really struck me because of the visual layout. And when you open to that page, you can see it's spread out over the page, and there's a lot of interesting line breaks, and it looks very fragmented on the page. But when she was reading it, it wasn't as fragmented, and so I had this little bit of a conflict as what to do as a composer, because we talked about this a little bit today, too, because visually I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking of these kind of fragments, but the way it's read is much more connected, and so I was really interested in that, in a way, a dissonance between what you see and what you hear. And the other thing about that poem is because it's based on her experiences in China, and she has a lot of references to China, so there's some Chinese words in there. I knew immediately that I wanted to use some kind of sonic reference that has a kind of a connection with China, and there's a lot of metallic percussion instruments, particularly gong sounds, which I use in here. And I don't think I mentioned this. I'm very much into kind of structural processes, as Alice mentioned, and I didn't say anything about this earlier, but I wanted to create a kind of background that's this continuous gong sound that goes through this piece. And in addition to that, there's this kind of chatter that you hear that's processed that comes from an Asian marketplace. So you'll hear, or a Chinese specifically marketplace, so you'll hear some Chinese language spread around here. But the gongs that are spread throughout the four speakers, you'll hear sound coming from all around you here. I wanted to have some kind of interesting distribution of those gongs. And I used a process, a musical process called isorhythm, which is a very, very old technique, goes back to the medieval era. And where you have a cycle of pitches that repeats over and over again, and another cycle of rhythms that repeats over and over again, and those cycles don't always match each other. So let's say you have in this case, I have a cycle of seven different gong pitches. I mean, they're pitched from high to low. They're not specific pitches, but they're seven different pitch material gongs. And then I have another series of, I think it's eight rhythms. And actually, I didn't mention this, but the rhythms, I wanted to come up with an interesting rhythmic pattern, and I based it, I do this sometimes just looking for interesting ideas. I took the Morse code dashes and dots from the initials in your name, actually, and came up with that. So alternating the dashes and dots that would be E-L-R, right? And I use those as the kind of, I figured, I'll just use the poet's initials. That'll give me a good framework for the rhythm. So, in fact, you're hearing the rhythmic pattern based on those Morse code interpretations of those your initials, and then the sound moving around the speakers, and then these patterns. So there's all this stuff going on. Most people think, I don't really care about that. I just want to hear the music. But those kinds of things interest me when there's these kind of interesting processes going on. And I think if you know something about that, it does help when you're listening to it to kind of, you don't have to know exactly where you are in the process, but to know that there is some kind of a process like that going on, I think is very helpful. And in addition to the sound of the gongs and the Chinese speaking, there are a number of other sounds that come from her voice, the Chinese Yue Bing, which I'm not pronouncing right, I'm sure, not doing the inflection right, but I used her speaking of these Chinese words and then process those. So a lot of the sounds you hear in there are processed voice material as well. I do want to say something about the setting of this as far as the computer music goes, and I alluded to this a moment ago. And I will say this in comparison with the work I did for Alice earlier, that this work is created by individual sound files that are triggered by the computer based on the reading of the text. So as the poet is reading, when he or she gets to a certain line, I'll just hit the trigger and then another sound file will start, and then I'm just kind of following them. In some cases, as in the case of Beth's piece, there's a single track that goes continuously, so she has to kind of have a general idea of where she is in the timing, but that a lot of specific sound files, sonic material that's directly related to the poem will be triggered based on the poem. So you'll clearly hear a word will come out and you'll hear something referenced in the sound there. But it also makes it a little bit, well, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking for the poets. They probably don't think it's very easy, because I think it's odd for someone that's used to doing a reading of his or her poem without having to worry about music to have to sit there and wait for cues and look at me to make sure I'm cueing off of them. That's obviously a little bit of an odd situation, but it's at least a little bit more of an interactive thing going on here where I'm kind of responding to the poem, and in some cases they're listening for cues before they say the next line of text. And as a result of that, I should also mention that the software I'm using, just to put a shout out for one of my colleagues here, is a software called Pure Data, which was developed by Miller Puckett, who's at UC San Diego, and my colleague at University of North Texas, Andrew May, was the one that came up with the patch that I'm going to be using for tonight. So he's a real whiz with Pure Data and MaximusP. So this piece wouldn't have worked without that patch from him. So I will make that comment and thank Andrew for that. But what I was going to say, and kind of in closing here, is that one thing to be aware of, and these pieces are odd in a way because they're kind of neither fish nor fowl. I mean, it's a poetry reading with computer music, and so they're kind of out of place in a concert because you're not used to seeing people reading poems at a concert, but they're also a little out of place in a poetry reading because you're not used to hearing music. So it's a piece that doesn't really have a home very easily. I mean, you're, obviously when you come to these readings, you very rarely see this kind of equipment around for the reading. So it's a little bit of an unusual situation, both from a standpoint of a concert or for a poetry reading. And the other thing that's gonna be a little unusual for you to be aware of is that when a poet comes up here and reads his or her work, that person will pace a certain way, and there'll be maybe some breaks here and there, but there's a more or less a continuous flow of words coming out. Well, if that were to happen, these pieces would be about 30 seconds long because the poems are very short. So as I mentioned earlier, I had to build in some breaks in the poems and some places where the music could kind of come through, which is one of the things that makes it a little bit awkward for the poets because they have to pause a lot when they wouldn't normally pause and kind of wait for the music to happen. So don't be alarmed when you see them stop up here. They're not forgetting their lines. They're just waiting for the music to happen. I need to make that clear. It's kind of an odd, again, for a poetry reading, it's a kind of an odd situation to be aware of. And the other thing I would mention just in closing here is that to keep in mind, typically when you would do a poetry reading, one poet would come up and read, and then there would be applause, and they would sit down, and then another one come up, and there would be applause. Because this is written as a set, I'd like you, if you wouldn't mind, holding your applause till the end of the set so that we have all four poems read, and then at the end we can acknowledge all four of them. I'm wondering if I'm missing anything. I think I've...
You got it.
I got everything. Wow. I didn't use my notes that much. So anyway, again, thank you, and thank you to Alice and Cornell, and I hope you enjoy. This is the premiere performance of Cornell Set.
Gorge dweller, evensong. At the throat of this tree, you see me kneel, steep into leaves and pockets of shale. My voice hollows out veins in roots. I look to you to see you, fallen mouth from the sky, up where lips round off over descant. Steep into leaves and pockets of shale. Open, rain-beaded blossom, uvular angles, where rocks fall out of themselves, utter, up where lips round off over descant. I want to go back to roof, mouth, ever so filled, to the lips before the fall, words spill, where rocks fall out of themselves, utter. A prayer, both limb and leaf bent skyward, and the calm before collapse, creek cut, at the lips before the fall, a word spill. From leaf tongue, Father, from the cracks and the calm before collapse, creek cut, in the throat of this tree, you see me kneel, my voice hollows out veins in roots.
Elegy for a car.
Vultures with beer bellies pick and prod at a heap with gas-tinged beaks. The beast on cinder blocks sits in the sun that's thick, like the sound of kicking a big dog in the ribs. The drum boom muted by fur. A father and sons stroll through the mud to the dripping carcass, menaced by mustaches that, with a drop of gasoline, could clean a car part for a jewelry display case. Time rears its fangs more openly here. I can see the upper gums, my God.
What is broken? It rains and rains. The wind rocks a branch. The branch taps the chain link fence, chiming at each flick. Thing, thing, thing. Discarded. As of no worth, like a human touched hatchling, brushed from the limb on which it was born. Maybe you've taken one in before, kept it on peanut butter and millet. Shut up in a box, for its own sake, and to keep it from taking a shit on all the things you love to love. You're happy to see it go, proud even. All the while thinking you had fixed something you had done, but had not.
In mid-autumn, Shanxi Province, 2007. The moon was not the moon, but it was moon, yes, and cake, yue bing. Bing, I cried, ice or sickness, depending, sweet heart. You are still where you are. The kitchen, again. The cricket's vibrato in the sink. The onion turned, blushed by the window, Sick, a hush slides on bathroom tile, blue and white. Ice alone finds its way to bed. Yea, I said, moon or breathing, you come, draw the circle, reach north where I stand. Night is the syrup cupped between our hands.
Much, and to my poet friends there for the excellent reading. So I do appreciate your cooperation in all this. I know it's kind of odd to read your poetry in this context, but I very much enjoyed writing these settings because it gave me an opportunity to work with several different poems with different voices and different approaches to the music that I could take with these. So. What I wanted to say now is just a few words about the work that I wrote initial to this, and that is the piece of Alice's, and I want to give a little bit of background. She mentioned a little bit about how we met and how I had emailed and contacted her, and in fact, it turns out I think I ended up using three of your titles or your poetry lines for different titles of poems, and at some point I thought, you know, instead of just ripping off her really great poetry lines for titles. And composers do this all the time. We are always at a loss for titles. I'm sure poets as well, right? It's always hard to come up with titles. And so composers just go to poets because they're better with words than we are, so we just rip them off for lines. But I thought, you know, I really would like to set her poetry to actual music and not just take the lines. And I had an offer from a colleague of mine, Henry Gibbons at the University of North Texas, probably back in 1994, not long after I got there, he wanted me to write a piece for the choir. He'd done a lot of contemporary music. And I had in my mind I wanted to do something with choir, with mixed choir and computer music. And it's kind of interesting. I've been presented as a computer music composer, not here, but actually when I met Roberto Sierra over at the music school, we had lunch today. And I guess if you do anything with computer, they just kind of label you a computer music composer. And I feel really odd about that because I've come to it kind of late, and primarily because University of North Texas has this really great computer music program, and I came there without having any computer music under my belt, and you get there and you're totally seduced by the equipment and the students that really work well with computers and the faculty that are so knowledgeable. And so as a result, I've written a lot more pieces with computer than I'd never written anything until about 97, I guess, that use computer. Now a lot of the works that I've done have used those. So this choral piece I had in mind was also going to be with computer. And my interest in that was not dissimilar from what you heard in this piece, where I took the sounds of the poems and sometimes manipulated them and used the vocal sounds for the source material for the computer. But in the case with the choral music, I wanted to do the same thing, but no external sounds, only using the vocal sounds. And to create a situation where you wouldn't know what was coming from the computer and what was coming from the choir a lot of times. I mean, at some point you'd hear something that clearly wasn't done by human voices, but there was this kind of elision between the computer music and the choral music. That was the intention. So I already had this all in mind, what I was going to do, and I was pouring through Alice's poetry. I think I read every single one of your books of poetry, and I was feeling more and more upset as I got near the end of the books, realizing I didn't see anything that spoke to me as a choral piece. I really so much wanted to set her music. And I just got to the end. I thought, well, nothing is really, I'm not feeling a choral piece in any of these poems. They were great for a lot of other things. And in fact, as I was thinking about voice settings with chamber music and all these other things that I didn't really want to write at the time. And I thought, file those away. I'll do those at some other point. And as I got to the end of this kind of looking through here, I realized what I really wanted was to keep the purity of the poems and to create this computer music setting as a kind of environment for the poems. As you've already heard now with these the four pieces that were done just now. And that was what I wanted to do with Alice's pieces. And it was when I started to come up with the idea of how odd it is to do a poetry reading when you have music, and it's not really a music piece, it's not really poetry, it's kind of a little bit of a mixture of both. But I like the idea of maintaining, in some way, the purity of the poem. Whereas if you set it to a choral piece, or you set it to, say, a soprano with an ensemble, you're always manipulating it in somewhat unnatural ways. You're making melodies out of it and doing all these things that the poet never intended. I'm sure I'm doing things that the poets don't intend either with these settings, but at least I'm trying to maintain some sense of the kind of integrity of the original poem. As it turned out, I did write the choral piece a few years later, and it was, I ended up finding two parables by Franz Kafka that I really liked. And so nothing like Alice Fulton's work at all, but it really, I saw these parables, it's like, that's what I should have been setting for these choral pieces. And that was, again, for computer music with narrator. But in these felt settings, I had, after reading through all the books, I think felt was probably at that point, about 2004, the most recent book of your poetry. So that was, and I had gotten a lot of material from Sensual Math. That's where I got some of the titles from, and I really liked that book. That was probably the first book that I came across. In fact, I maybe need to backtrack even before you talk about when we met and how I found out about Alice's poetry. And I was at a bookstore, and it's probably about 1994, and I was looking through books of poetry. I was really interested in some contemporary poetry, and I came across one of those anthologies, the greatest American or best American poetry of whatever year it was. I don't remember what year it was, but so I'm flipping through the book, looking at the different poets. Some of them I recognized, a lot of them I didn't, and I see Fractal Lanes. Wow, that's pretty cool. Someone wrote a poem about fractals. I was really interested in that. A lot of computer composers were. I was interested in it from acoustic music standpoint, and had been reading James Gleick's book, Chaos, and had been interested in Benoit Mandelbrot, who was the guy that came up with the term fractal geometry. I thought, oh, I got to read this poem. And so I opened the book, and I read this poem, and realized that I cheated and looked and saw what it said in the annotations, but there was an acrostic down the side that says, if I'm getting this right, bowling develops the right arm. Is that the acrostic? And I thought, this is pretty cool, because, you know, there's this little acrostic down there, and then the poem's about, the poem kind of references lanes, and I thought the interesting idea of fractals, and I thought, this is a poet I've got to look into more. I was trying to remember, okay, I'm really bad with names, and how am I going to remember? I didn't have a pencil or anything like that. And I remembered that we have in Denton, where I live, there are two streets that are across one of the main highways in town. And one of them is Alice Street, and the next street's Fulton Street. And they're actually consecutive streets. So I needed a mnemonic device. I'm thinking, okay, I'll just remember on University Avenue where those streets intersect, and I'll remember that, and I'll go home and I'll write it down. So I went home, and I wrote down, I thought, I got to start looking up more of this poet's work. And then, just a real weird serendipitous thing, I had a composition student who was working with me, and he comes to a lesson, like 1 or 2 weeks after I discovered this poem, and he said, I've been reading this poet, Alice Fulton, have you heard of her before? And I'm like, oh, yes. And so we had this kind of very excited exchange in one of these lessons, and he was bringing out the books. I think he had Dance Script with Electric Ballerina, and I think he was reading Palladium at the time, and I was showing I got Sensual Math, I'm going to look at that. And so it was kind of like kids sharing baseball cards or something like that, you know. They probably don't do that anymore, do they? That's a really old reference, but when I was a kid. And so we were both very excited about the poetry and talking about things that we really liked about it, and so that really got me inspired to finally contact her. So I found out she was at the University of Michigan. I screwed up enough nerve to say, hey, I'm a composer, you don't know who I am, but I'd like to steal some of your lines of your poetry for titles. And that's how we ended up with this correspondence, and just giving her my background, as she mentioned, my interest in Darcy Thompson and Elias Canetti, among others, that we had a kind of sympathetic interest in certain artists. And so that was kind of how our communication and eventually our friendship kind of formed from that. And it's been really great over the years. We don't get to see each other that much or be in communication, but I'm always interested in what she's doing, and she's been very supportive, as has Hank, her husband, always very supportive of my work. So kind of getting back to this particular project, I contacted her about the idea of doing this text setting, and she was very interested in that. And we ended up, I thought, because a number of composers have already set a lot of her poems, that I wanted to have a program. At this time, I think I was still, no, I guess I wasn't conducting the New Music Ensemble anymore at UNT, but we had a conductor there who had a kind of flexibility for the program, and I asked this conductor, can we do a program where we just feature music that's influenced by Alice Fulton, basically settings of her work. So we had four composer, Enid Sutherland, who's at the University of Michigan, I guess a colleague of Alice's there, Anthony Cornicello, and actually his work I'd seen pretty early on as well, because it was one of the early settings I saw. And one of my doctoral students at the time, James Worlton, had done a setting for his, well, one of his dissertation pieces was a setting of Alice's poems, and then this setting of mine that I was working on. So we ended up putting this program together, and Alice and Hank came out, and Alice did the performance of her piece, of my piece of hers, and then there were other, the other composers were there as well. So it was really fun to have this collection of composers that had this all this connection with Alice's work, and we were able to share in a panel discussion about how we all kind of approached her poetry and how it influenced our work. And there's a lot of music in her poetry. For those of you who know her work, that's one of the things that really drew me to it, is that she writes about music in ways that a musician would appreciate, because it's completely authentic, and it's like it understands music from the inside. I think she also does that with a lot of things in the sciences. I know you have a friend, John Holland, who's also at Michigan, who was a scientist friend, and a lot of connections there. So those are the kinds of things I've really appreciated about using her work. Let me just say a couple quick words about the poems, and then we'll do this performance. I think we're probably on time here. The three that I chose from Feld, I was looking for three very different poems. And the first one, Prequel, if you look at it in the setting there, one of the things that I really liked about it is it has this kind of stream of consciousness, continuous flow of words that kind of bounce off of each other and transform into each other, and not much of a narrative sense, but this kind of turbulent quality to it. And there's also references to tornadoes and storms, and if you look at the poem, you can actually see it looks like a tornado. I think I'm interpreting that right, aren't I? I'm always afraid when the poet's here and I'm saying, this is what you're supposed to see in this work, is a tornado. But that's what I saw, the way the lines keep moving around like a kind of a tornado funnel like that. And so as a result of the layout of the poem and the content, there's a lot of source material from various sources, cricket sounds, wind sounds, rain sounds, turbine sounds, all kinds of things that are kind of referenced in the poem. And there's a lot of this kind of wind sound in the background. So the music actually kind of sounds like a tornado with all these things kind of getting sucked up into it. That was my intention of that setting. The second poem is quite different. As you see, the layout is very straightforward. It's very kind of traditional layout. It's a poem about suicide. And from the perspective of the suicide victim. So I found it very interesting, very moving poem, and very introspective. And as a result of this kind of obsessive quality of the poem, at least what I got out of it, I decided, in contrast to the first movement, which has all these different sounds kind of flying at you, I focused exclusively on two sounds. One was the sound of Alice's voice for a couple of fragments of text-based sounds in there, and the other one was guitar sounds. And what you're going to hear in that is a lot of these kind of hairpin fading in, fading out sounds that sound like horns or like feedback, but it's actually all from guitar sounds that have been processed. So a guitar can't fade in, so you have to do a lot of, you know, messing around with it to get to do that. And there's some other guitar sounds that I think you'll recognize. And the reason for using the guitar is, if you notice, there's a line in there that makes reference to the sound of strings and frets that released when a guitarist changes chords. And I thought that was an interesting metaphor. And it also kind of directly led me into the idea of using guitar sounds for the movement. And then the final one, called The Mainland, is another one different from the others. I think it's, what I like about it is it has a real strong fractal content to it, that there's this kind of fragmentation. The opening line of it, or the opening section of it, is this kind of fantasy contemplation of nature, and then suddenly it breaks, and the writer is saying, whoa, it's like time out, and kind of it just totally cuts into it and breaks into that kind of fantasy. And then the middle section has this kind of more kind of rational contemplation of nature, and then it kind of comes back again to more of the fantasy at the end. And I like that idea of that. I imposed upon this a three-part form, whether it was there or not. That's what I saw in it, and use a lot of the sounds from nature, particularly bird sounds in there. And that's kind of predominates the outside sections. And then the middle sections have actually some of the sounds of the guitar from the previous movement and some other sounds that sound more like natural heartbeats and breathing sounds. And so what I said finally about this is that, as I mentioned with the first set of poems, each of the tracks is triggered. In this set, poor Alice had to deal with what we call fixed media, where it's like in the old tape music, where you just start the tape and it runs and it doesn't stop and it doesn't stop, and then it just stops when it ends. It gets to the end and you stop it, which means that the reader has to have a stopwatch and be very precise with the timing. It's a very difficult thing to do. And at the time, I had wanted to do a setting similar to what we did with the Cornell set, but I didn't have time to do it, and I didn't have the resources at the time. And so since then, and Alice has been, you know, very gracious about accommodating me with this, the timings and everything. But in this version of it, I revised it a couple weeks ago, where a few of the cues are actually triggered off of the poem. So she still has to follow a watch for the most part, more so than the previous set. But at least some of the cues are kind of triggered off of her lines. I think it's a little more forgiving, do you think, Alice? Maybe a little bit? And finally, I'll just say that, as Alice said, all these pieces, not only her work, but the Cornell set, will have a life outside of these performances and these poets, because as now pieces of music, they will be performed by other people reading them. And in fact, Alice's work, the setting of her work, in addition to Alice doing it, this will be her third time, I think, right? In addition to those performances, there's been like a dozen other performances by other people, mostly around the country. I think there was a performance in Taiwan is the only international one. And so many people have actually read this. So I've actually had the experience of seeing it take a life outside of the original poet. And it creates an interesting counterpoint, because a lot of the sounds that come from in the music are coming from Alice speaking. So when somebody else does it, you actually hear this interesting counterpoint between the person reading it and the music coming out of the computer. So with that, I will say this is three poems from Felt and with Alice Fulton. Thank you.
Prequel. Before the blank, full of fresh grain scent and flecked like oatmeal woven flat, canvas. Before the blank, canvas is stretched or strained, tight as an egg. Before then, sketch. It doesn't catch commencement. It won't hook the scene like a rug or strategize too far ahead. It isn't chess. It doesn't expect the home stretch or the check. Each line braves rejection of the every, edits restless all into a space that's still the space of least commitment, distilling latitudes in draft. It would domesticate the feral dusk and stockpile dawn. It would be commensurate, but settles for less. Settles prairies in its channels. Great plains roar and waterfall, yawn and frost between the lines. From hunger, from blank and black, it models erotic, stopped tornadoes, the high relief of trees. In advance or retreat, in terrace dynamics, its bets are hedged with no deadbolt perspective. Its point of view, one with the twister in Vista Glide, and the cricket in the ditch, with river rain and turbines trace, inside the flux of flesh and trunk and cloudy cum, within the latent marrow of the egg, the amber traveling waves is where its vantage lies, entering the tornado's core, entering the cricket waltzed by storm, to confiscate the shifting give and represent the width out which. by her own hand. If you believe, you would have caressed every lash and freckle that I was, but for decorum, I appreciate the thought. Have you ever been embarrassed by a frugal kiss? It is embarrassing to live. My love for my husband was all balled up with mothering. I had compassion for any flesh trying that hard to be iron. Imagine living with his bluster and hiss for 40 years. Have you ever been embarrassed by a frugal kiss? I died of it. Just say I sublimed. Snowflakes do this all the time. Say I was tired of eating beige, for heaven's sake, of molestations imposed by my own body. Let's see. I wasn't stoical enough for me. You might say I've eased into the trees and the autistic fields. Eyes like forget-me-nots, desire, all that business you admire. The human yen for angels is depraved. It decorates death with heaven, longing for the note I never left. My last sound was like the small release of strings and frets you sense when a guitarist changes chords. Enough to let you know the music's made by hand. I am not without regrets, picayune as they may seem, or plain grotesque. I do regret the writhing. I wanted to be self-reliant. I wanted to reach up and shut my own eyes just before I died. Call the mainland. Nature hates a choir. Have you noticed the lack of chorus in the country every dawn? The birds spent the night looking down on Earth as that opaque, unstarred space. The vivacious soundscape they create at day must be their amazement that the planet's still in place. No, wait. Time out and woe. There I go, coding the birds' tones with emotion, hearing them as my own. I know, I know. Yet I can't say birds aren't feeling, in their hollow bones, some resonance of glad that night has passed. I can't claim their hearts don't shake when the will to live another day in the cascade of all that is strong. Emotion makes its presence felt in flesh. Maybe you've noticed. The body speeds its reflexes and is moved. It moves. It makes the heart, lungs, and gut remember their lives like sleepers between bouts of sleep. While more serene delights are intellect selective, without cardiac effect. The mind sparks at a Borges story or elegant proof in math, a bliss that doesn't shift across the blood-brain barrier. Such heady pleasures are never for the birds. To be key rather than bit player of independent means, to sound your own agenda in polyphonic overlay as day takes shape. As day takes shape, the birds begin their final take. They'll never know themselves as symbols of the sublime, transcendent, messy shrines whose music won't stoop to unison or climax. Tell them I said hi. Well, we hope you'll... Okay. Okay. We hope you'll stick around for a brief Q&A if you have any questions for the poets, the students, and for Joe. So we won't linger too long, but if there's anything you'd like to ask, we're here and ready for questions. And there's a reception with food, and it's in Goldwin Smith, as usual. It's near the lounge, in the area near the lounge on the second floor. So please join us after the Q&A for a reception in Goldwin Smith with food.
So musicians have to hear that a lot, too. There's food, there's food. Yes, there's a question.
Hi. Could you tell us a little more about the technical side of what we were hearing? That is, I see a lot of equipment, but mm-hmm. I don't know how it produces,
well, yeah, the computer has all the sound in them in separate files, and then what I'm doing on the laptop is just every time I hit the space bar, it triggers the next cue, and a lot of them overlap each other, and in some cases, like in most of Alice's poems and in Ben's poem, there was a single track that went through the whole thing, and then other cues happen on top of that. And then all this other stuff is just so we can all hear it. The cables and everything like that. And of course, Barney was a huge help in all this.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
It looks more complicated than it really is, believe it or not. I mean, it's a little daunting when you see all the cables and everything. But once you get it set up in the system, it just hit space bar. I mean, how hard is that? I can even do it. I'm not a tech guy. It's just like, hit the space bar. So that's about all there is to that part of it. The hard work actually is probably more of the stuff that goes into making the sounds that takes a lot of time, so. Anything else? Everyone will ask questions at the reception,
here's
I
one.
Bet, so.
Okay.
Yeah. First, I just want to congratulate my fellow peers in the college for that really stellar performance and for you coming to campus at Alice Bolton as well. And it's sort of a question that's stemming from the conversation that we had for this past lunch. Our love, both for Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails, and becoming sort of like the catalyst for industrial electronic music going forward. And making that transition from album to also composing cinema. That was really interested in you. In your perfect utopian world, like, what would be your favorite directors going forward?
Oh my gosh. I like Chris Nolan a lot. And, I used to like Quentin Tarantino. I think I'm kind of mixed bag on him right now, but he'd be hard to write for because he takes a lot of music that pre-exists and everything and kind of puts it together in an interesting way. I like a lot of like more independent filmmakers, you know, and some of the indie films that I can't think of any. Linklater was one that for a while ago, and I'm trying to think of Richard Linklater. And I'm kind of more interested in the music that goes to those films because they're not having to pander to the box office and all that, and so the composer can kind of do what he or she wants. And so that's, in a way, it's interesting that we talked about Trent Reznor winning the Academy Award today, or this year for Social Network, which is a pretty mainstream movie. And here's a guy that was kind of outside of the mainstream for a long time, and now he's separated into the mainstream. So I think it's a good thing. And more, what will probably happen is more people will listen to that music from the movie and then go listen to his other music. I think maybe the people that might have been a little bit afraid of Nine Inch Nails, you know, we'll come to it from a different appreciation. So, but we had talked about this earlier. The interesting thing to me is that there's the boundaries between kind of popular idioms, you know, and I, again, it's relatively speaking. I mean, Trent Reznor isn't as popular as, say, like Justin Bieber, let's say, right? If you want to make that extreme case like that. But it's more popular than George Ligeti or Edgard Varèse, let's, you know, to put an example of a classical composer. But there's a lot more crossover going on now between electronic music used in popular context and used in classical or art context. And I think that's good. I think it's breaking down those walls because my son used to think my music was so weird, and then he started listening to Nine Inch Nails. He'd come in and say, "You know, he's doing some of the stuff that you do." It's like, "Yeah, well, it's, we're all doing the same thing. You know, we're all using the same materials, some of the same equipment. Is it just more expensive than mine?" So, anyway, I don't know if that answered your question, but we can talk more.
when this music is performed outside, like in different venues, do you just send them the music files and stuff, or do you go? Like, how does?
Yeah. This is the difficult problem of computer music is a lot of times it's written in a way that you have to have the guy that wrote it there to perform it because nobody else knows the software or whatever, or at least a handful of the tech geeks that know this stuff really well. You know, I say that in all the best way. But when I did the Kafka piece, I put it all on a CD. So all you had to do was push a forward button on a CD. So someone just sits down there, and like I'm doing with the space bar, every time they see a little cue in the music, they would just hit forward on the CD and go to the next track. So that's pretty easy. And now in this case, it's set up in a way that it could be done that way as well. Like Alice's piece could be done that way because it's set up, and you've done it that way with the
yeah,
CD,
absolutely.
Right? The problem with this is that the original version was 8 channels, and I mixed it down to 4 channels. And of course, CDs play 2 channels, unless you did a DVD, and that could probably be done like with a DVD, just with a 5.1 sound. So that's a really long and probably a non-answer, but it does show you that there's a lot of issues with that, and the composer oftentimes has to go to the performance to make it happen. And a lot of these pieces are performed on these festivals of electronic music, and so there's a bunch of tech geeks there already, and they know how to do it, so you can hand it over to them. But I personally like to be involved in it.
Is there a computer music equivalent to the jam session? Do you live stuff?
Oh, yeah, like laptop performances and things like
yeah,
that?
Just digging through mm-hmm. files that strike you.
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of our colleagues at UNT has a laptop ensemble, and it's kind of that kind of jamming with, I mean, infinite number of possible sounds you can do with a laptop like that.
How many people can you keep going at once without it becoming
a mayhem? It's probably like even, imagine an ensemble, an improvisational ensemble of performers of traditional instruments. And you can have very sensitive performers and have 10 people and they're all listening to each other and paying attention and getting out of the way of each other. Or you can have 10 people that are just blowing as loud as they can and just not paying attention to anybody. So it's the same thing with laptops. If you get a bunch of guys that are just sitting there into their own laptop and they're not listening to anybody, it's not going to be a good performance. But I've heard some really very sensitive performances with laptop ensembles, and you'll see some things like someone will come up with a sound and it'll make someone else chuckle, and they'll start to program something that kind of responds to it. And considering the amount of sound possibilities you have as opposed to say a cello or an oboe, it's pretty rich resource for improvisation. And there are groups that are like that. One of our students formed a group at the University of Montana, a laptop ensemble. So now you've got student groups that are coming in and playing in these groups. So.
So you were talking earlier today about musical tone and poetic tone. How did you decide to translate the poetic tone into this sort of musical tone? What was the process? And, do you think it altered in any way the original poetic tone?
Yes, I think so. In fact, I was really worried when I sent in the music, is like, this is going to be okay? We talked about this a little bit, that is this going to be okay? It's not too far off of what you had in mind. And, you know, again, when you're working with dead poets, it's okay because they're not going to say anything to you, right? And, I mean, you know, I always talk about how dead composers can get away with anything because there's nobody to complain about to them. But, you know, living ones have to deal with people complaining about what we write for them. But so I figure I'm dealing with the poets that are here that I'm going to be working with, and I was concerned it was going to be too far afield. Everybody seems to be very open-minded about it, even if I did some things that were not what they had in mind, they seem to be pretty cool about, yeah, that's a good interpretation, that works. It's just a different interpretation, I guess. But I, even in my own interpretations of it, I think I even reinterpreted the tone. We talked about this with Beth's piece, that it came out to be a lot darker piece than I thought it was going to be. It has this kind of ominous quality to it. And I really wasn't thinking like that at all, but as I started getting into it, and the sounds started taking a life of their own, and then as I'm listening to the text with those sounds, then the text started to go dark, seem darker to me, you know. So it was like this feedback loop. And I enjoyed that I came out in a different place than I was expecting to be when I started the process. So.
You talk a lot about intent and intention, which seems to be like a very complicated issue. But some of the sounds that I heard it seemed almost like unintentional sounds of like cell phones going off, or like the accidental sound. Do you ever incorporate or try to integrate like the accidental or the unintentional sound into or?
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to think if I've done that with computer music. Probably not, because it's so set. I mean, even though I'm controlling when these things happen, it's the sounds themselves are pretty set. But I've done that with acoustic music a lot, where you have these kind of improvisational constructs where you give people a certain certain parameters, and then you know that there's some leeway for them to interpret it. And what comes out, you don't exactly know what to expect. You know what you kind of want to hear. And if you're, you know, probably you've heard of John Cage, or many people have heard of John Cage, where basically anything goes, and, you know, there's no intention at all. His intention was to remove intention, as he said. Then it's, you know, it's a total surprise for the composer. Most composers don't like that degree of surprise. Cage was very hands-off about the whole thing. But I like to have some idea of where the thing is going. And I'm thinking with your comments about the more sounding unintentional sounds, there were some that maybe sounded outside of the poem, perhaps, or kind of tangential to the poem, as opposed to the really direct ones. You could hear a cricket sound or a sound of gongs that made you think of China. Those were maybe more direct. But I didn't want it to be too literal all the way through. I wanted some things that maybe were a little bit more, up to the interpretation of the audience, I guess. I don't know if that answered that question, but good. Anything else?
Yeah, I was interested in hearing more about the poet's experience here. I mean, like, I'm thinking about...
I would, too.
Right, as you're reading your poem, and was that intuitive to sort of have these pauses or to be sort of playing to another sort of art form that's happening simultaneously? And also, back to what you were saying about that it's maybe perhaps a different interpretation than you had intended, and sort of what that process was like for the poets.
Yeah, I'm particularly interested now that you've actually performed it, so what you feel.
What do you think? Why don't you each speak? If you all do. Yeah.
Well, I guess there are times in which you'll hear sort of the sounds in it, and it almost as if you're competing with them in a sense, and sometimes you want to avoid that, but other times it sort of creates another level of tension in the poem that maybe wasn't there before. And it's not exactly the same time, but it's not exactly the same every time we do it. It's similar. The timings work out to be more or less the same, but sometimes, you know, if you speak one word a little bit more quickly than you did last time, you might run into a sound that's in the score. And in that case, that word, it takes on another quality. It has a sort of new tension, if that makes sense.
No,
so
absolutely.
So there is an element of chance in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of has the performance
quality. Right,
yeah.
Right. And in fact, those are the kind of the intention of some of the parts that you just have to go along with and not cue it off of. It's like there'll be some chance alignments, and the other ones are very strict, though. So. Ben's turn.
I guess my experience with this poem, what was interesting to me was, I guess I built sound into my poem, and I wanted some of those sounds to be in the poem itself, so to hear a literal representation of some of those sounds, either working with or maybe even competing with some of the sounds that are in there is kind of interesting to me.
For me, I really liked how the sound sort of gave me a place and a setting, because even imagining myself as a listener, it really helped me be more grounded, because I don't immediately talk about the setting or where the events are taking place. So it really helped me get a sense of where I was, more specifically.
Okay, so I kind of wanted just to echo a little bit of what Beth had said. Mine was a prayer, a petition of sorts, and so. For me, the poem was composed in a gorge from an experience that I had. And so for me, it had a lot of silence. It was very reverent.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came here and we started rehearsing, it was, it was these very loud sounds, but definitely reminiscent of what was happening in the gorges when I was composing in my mind. the poem, and so I also had to speak up and sort of compete with these sounds that were happening, but these sounds that were also happening back when I was writing it. So it was interesting in that way for me to really speak that prayer. So mm-hmm. it was interesting that way to just really say it louder, say it out loud, and.
Well, it's funny that you said that yours was more silent. In fact, of the settings, of all four settings, that had the most sound in it. It's probably the busiest of all the four. So, oops, I missed that one.
That's okay.
I kind of thought, in a way, Beth's looked like it was more silent because it had so much space in it. So, again, I maybe was being very literal with the visual aspect of it. So.
Yeah, that was intentional.
Yeah. I don't know if you had any comment about that, about your piece, your poem.
Yeah, I really enjoy reading with the music. It's almost like another voice in the poem, as if you have someone that you're collaborating with up here. And usually you're up here alone. And it's nice to have another just presence. And also I think it affects the pace of the poem. It gets me out of some ruts as a reader, maybe, that I would read at a certain pace. And in this case, I'm reading at a pace that maybe isn't quite what I would do normally. And it actually makes me a little bit more agile or awake to it, I think. And I like to listen to the music. It's hard to do that when you're up here. But I try to listen, and that part is really nice if you can just hear it and almost forget that you're performing. That's really the best way to do it, I think. So I like it because it's different, and it shakes me up and gets me out of the old reading rut where you get up and you kind of mumble a few poems and then you sit down. You know, it's different. Isn't that good? I like to get shaken up. I like to try new things. And this, for me, was totally new. The stopwatch, I'm not good at... I'm terrible at this stuff. But you have to try this. The more uncomfortable it is, the better I think it is for me to do it, really.
So all these other things that you have to think about instead of just reading the poem, which is very nerve-wracking, I would think. So.
But it's good. I mean, I like that. I like that. I like it that it's a little bit dangerous.
Yeah, it's definitely dangerous. I think you guys all felt a little danger in there when you were talking about it. So I think we're probably...
Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming tonight.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.